So it's a real delight to share the evening with someone who's become a good friend who I so respect and appreciate and admire all the work that she's doing in the world, and that is Alyssa Epple, who you'll meet in a few moments, who's just come out with this book called The Stress Prescription, the subtitle 7 Days to More Joy and Ease. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? It is good. It really is good. I wrote a blurb saying, I love this book. And when you write blurbs, you want to be supportive for people, but I was just saying, what's true? I love this book. It's science-based presentation of how to practice in a way that brings more joy and ease. Like the title says, very user-friendly, very engaging. It's like you're with a friend who's saying, "Hey, this is the research. Come do it with me." And I'm so glad that she could join us and be with us. We were speaking a little while ago. This is her third presentation. I think she was on two podcasts earlier today. She's a busy girl, and she was in the Boston Globe that just came out. She's in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, last week, and it's got a bit of a buzz, this book, which is just really great. Because I think everybody should read it. And we're going to explore together what she's written about. And Alyssa, just a little bit about her. She's she's in the Department of Psychology, the vice chair, I think it is, of Department of Psychology at UCSF. And she wrote a book, co-wrote a book with Elizabeth Blackburn that was kind of revolutionary. I'm going to spotlight you so everybody sees who you are. There you are. There's Alyssa. A book called The Telomere Effect, which has been really revolutionary in showing how stress affects us physiologically, the ends of the chromosomes, these telomeres, that stress and aging, that Elizabeth Blackburn got the Nobel Prize for. And Alyssa is her co-author and does fabulous work in the world in so many different ways, which we won't go into now. But Alyssa, it's great to have you here, and looking forward to us hanging out and introducing you to our community.
Thank you so much, James. It's so nice to be here under with lots of like-minded friends. I recognize many of your names, and a few people popped on who just learned about it last minute. One of them is on the East Coast. So, Susan, I hope you don't stay up till midnight. Well, but I'm happy to see you, and Jeff and others. So thanks for joining us. This is most definitely, this isn't giving a talk, James. I did do some today, and I'm not always so busy in the media. It's just the book just came out. But one of my favorite things to do is to talk about science and contemplative science or Buddhism back and forth and how they integrate and how they give different insights so that together there's more rich wisdom, wisdom that's relevant to our human lives. There's limits to science. And that's where I've gotten so much out of actually James teaching and others. James doesn't know this, but I think I started being in listening to you either in person in large groups or recordings 15 years ago. And 5 years ago, I wrote The Telomere Effect. And I didn't know James personally, but you were in my acknowledgments. And then over the last 5 years, we have been connecting more over our eco sangha interests in climate change and other joyous topics.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, and what we decided, we thought we'd do is have a bit of a conversation where I could just draw out of Alyssa some of the points about the book, and we could explore together for a while and then have a conversation and open it up to discussion for the community. And this is, she was saying, this is a special kind of a presentation or an appearance, because she can come out of the closet and say, yes, this is based on Buddha Dharma, and doesn't have to hold back. Great to see you as a longtime practitioner sharing all of this wisdom in such a user-friendly, practical way.
So much.
Mm-hmm. So as we were talking, and I was thinking about what to ask, I said, well, what do you think I should ask? And she said exactly the first thing that I wrote. She said, well, usually people ask me, why did you write this book? And that was just what was on my mind. So maybe you can talk for a few moments why you wrote it.
We can definitely start there. Do you want to join me in the spotlight, James?
Oh yeah, yeah, sure. Okay, I will.
I think what we're...
there we go.
James and I talked about as a format, which I found very exciting, is answering a few of his questions, but then giving you an overview of the book and then going deep on a few topics and going back and forth with James, where I will talk about a topic like uncertainty or control, and then he's going to reflect on it in some cases from a more Buddhist perspective. And that's always fascinated me, is where the two meet, where the two differ. So your question.
First question.
Okay.
Where did you write it?
I also wonder, James, can people chat to each other? Can we enable that? Because I did have some questions for the group.
Sure.
Okay, great.
Do you want them to chat with to each other or toward the whole group?
To the whole group is what I'd like, but you can also let them individually chat. I assume some of you know each other. So.
Okay. All right. Do both. There you go.
I really do a lot of research for the past almost 30 years. It's been on the mind-body connection. And for the first decade, it was stress and trauma, how that gets under the skin, how it affects cells. And that's the Telomere Effect book, which was about how we age from genetics to lifestyle to mind to stress. And stress is where I go deep. And then for maybe the next decade, I went on my first retreat, and rather than talking about mindfulness and having just taken only MBSR, it kind of changed everything. So I'm a very high-strung type A person by nature, and need big doses to shift my state. So this book is most definitely strategies that I need and try and still work on. And so it's all, you know, stays alive for me. Psychologists like to study what their own issues are. So I'm a stress scientist. And when we wrote The Telomere Effect, it was people seemed most interested in the one chapter on understanding stress, chronic stress, and how that gets under the skin. And so this book is completely, I will just say, hands-on and practical. It was the challenge of trying to take all of this 50 years of stress science and apply some of it to practices that have already been shown to work with science. So it's different than other self-help books in that the chapter reviews science. It reviews some stories of people I know, their real life stories. Some of them you might know. And then it asks you to do a simple practice for no more than 10 minutes each of 7 days. And it's ridiculous that it says 7 day solution. I mean, I didn't ever really mean to write a book that said, you know, you can change your life in 7 days, but that was the challenge that my book agent, Doug Abrams, gave to me, and I couldn't say no. And so I think it's easy to read. You could read in 7 days, but the real challenge is finding one practice that you implement into your life. And aging is really about these, the small things that we do every day that add up to years and add up to our life. And so changing even one thing for 10 minutes a day can of course shift the trajectory. And that's what the book's about. So did I answer that?
Enough? Yeah. Well, and you're just reminding me, you know, when you say about scientists teach what they want to learn about. It's the same with Dharma teachers. You know, I'm whenever I give a talk, I'm giving myself a Dharma talk at the same time. So I can never have too much of it. And you already answered about how it's related to the telomere book. And I want to know, here you are a Dharma practitioner and a science researcher. How have you brought your practice into the book? Just, you know, what's the mindfulness is throughout, but could you say a little bit more how you have your own stealth Dharma transmission and into the book?
It's a really good question. There was a mandate from the publisher not to try to make it a, you know, bring too much mindfulness in and make it a book about mindfulness. And so it was this fine balance of bringing in, and you know, a lot of people will be novices, but bringing in just enough of what they need to know and do to enter each practice in a mindful state, because nothing works when we're mindless. We can't reflect, we can't, certainly can't change. So the making a book about stress and strategies without it being all about meditation was, I'll say, challenging, but a good challenge, because each practice asks us to do something that is the on the surface, the technology, but it brings people into mindfulness state. So for example, chapter 5 is nature immersion. And there is a practice of how you walk into a green place, urban green, near a tree, any type of green, be with your plant and open your sensory gates. And that's the window into mindfulness. Our sensory gates are everything. Mm-hmm. Another way that my practice helped inform the book is the understanding of the mind-body complex and how stress lives in our body. The word stress doesn't mean anything, so let me, you know, break it down, but let's just say threat. We carry threat with us. Threat is our fear type stress that we need for survival. It's great. It's amazing and beautiful that we can mount this huge threat response within seconds. And that's the only reason we're all here, because we can, our ancestors needed that for survival. And we kind of do too, but of course it's turned on too much. But how do we look under the hood, away from just the general word stress and overwhelm that turns on the alarms, mm-hmm. to what is happening here in the body? What emotions am I feeling? Where is it living in my body? And you can have that inquiry when you're in a high state of stress or when you're in a deep rest state. And it's all about discovery. So as you were leading us, James, it's just so reaffirmed for me, like, this is it. This practice does so many things that we study with science and that we talk about. But the practice does a lot of it implicitly without all the words and all the explanation. Mm-hmm. So let me get more specific.
Yeah.
I'll just introduce the states and then I'll let you talk, James.
Oh, great. Sure.
So one of the, with my colleague and several others, my colleague, Alexander Croswell, who is a also a health psychology researcher, we both are fascinated by the health psychology research, which shows that any mind-body practice that you do benefits you in certain ways. And there's not a good study that I've seen that says one is better than the other to the body. We have our preferences, but there's a commonality they're all creating change in some common ways. And I'm mostly talking about the more low arousal mind-body practices. We'll talk about the high arousal ones too. And so some of the commonalities are they're shifting the nervous state from a sympathetic tone to more parasympathetic dominance, more vagal tone.
That means when you say sympathetic tone, a more hyper alert or kind of a tone to a more receptive and relaxing and calming kind of a perspective.
Right. So the sympathetic nervous system is the alerting system and the stress, you know, a big part of the stress response system. So it controls the amygdala in the brain, or it's tied into the amygdala in the brain and the whole nervous system in the body in terms of activation. And then the parasympathetic nervous system inhibits the sympathetic. So we play with that all the time. Everything we do is shifting that around, and especially meditation. So we want to be flexible in our mind-body states, and we want to be upshifting when we need to energize, we need to respond to a stress, or we need to perform. And then we want to downshift and recover. And then we want, when everything is fine and we're safe, we want to really have parasympathetic dominance. And that may be a bit of a rare state these days. We are so hyper alert throughout the day without the nap and with all of the stimulation of our modern screens, etc. So part of my practice has made me just fascinated with thinking about these different states. So starting from stress, the red mind state, I hope you can see this. It's kind of virtual screen is crazy here. All the way down to, you know, deep blue rest states. And so the book, no one has discovered this yet. The book just came out, but that's the map for the book. So it's not just rainbow colors, because I like rainbow, but really we start with how do you work with that stress response? We need it. We don't have to feel threatened and fearful. We can actually feel energized and powerful and remind ourselves of the good that comes out of stress. Mm. So I call that being the lion, instead the lion chasing the gazelle instead of the frightened gazelle. How much are you the lion in your life versus the gazelle?
Mm. Mm.
Then there's our baseline, like what we walk around within the day. And the question for all of us is, what is our baseline? Are we at true baseline when we're not dealing with stress? And I think for most of us, the answer is no. Our baseline is more of a cognitive load state, of a stimulated state that's above a true relaxed baseline. So that's our challenge, is not just how do I cope with stress when it happens, which is like right in front of us. We know what the tough situations are, but really, how are we when we are relaxed, when there's nothing happening? Can we look inside and learn what our stress state really is and identify, using our emotions as data, et cetera, identify where we can let go? And so that's, James, your meditation was so fitting. That's what we do during a lot of what we do during meditation, especially when we have an excellent guide like you. So green mind is true relaxation. And we can, you know, so I would say watching TV, talking to a friend, this is not necessarily true relaxation. That is often a busy state when we're engaged, but it's good and we need more of it. So green mind is more of this being in nature, for example, would be green mind state when we're not feeling threatened and we're alert and engaged with things around us. And then there's something deeper than relaxation, and that's deep rest or blue mind states. And we probably get very little of those. And in fact, I can think of very few times in waking life when we really let go and let ourselves relax into a restorative state. And why this is so important is because I study cell aging, and the cells, all of the aging machinery is completely tied up with stress. So the signals are similar. When we're stressed, the cell is putting its energy into defense and you know, the body's doing things like mobilizing extra glucose, but the cell also has its defenses and it's catabolic. It's wearing out the cell. It's creating oxidative stress, which is pro-aging. Whereas when we really feel safe and we're deeply relaxed, that's when repair happens and housekeeping. And so we want to try to get more of this blue mind state.
Can I just, before you, can I just interject when you say it's so rare that people can, in their daily life, connect with the blue state of deep rest. And one thing that I've found that people who've done some real meditation practice or over a while, or especially who've gone on retreat, who know what that state is like, do have more access to that. So just want to put in my two cents that it's not like so remote for us here. If you've been practicing and you are fortunate enough to go on retreats, or the practice is deep within you, it's not that inaccessible to access if you know in your being what deep rest is like. So
I am so happy you made that point. That exactly fits my experience as well as the data. Many meditation studies that look at either a day, like some of Richie Davidson's studies, or a week, like some of our retreat studies, show that novices benefit, but not as deeply than experienced meditators, because they come in with a trained mind or a already conditioned mind-body complex. And so they're getting there quickly and benefiting more. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. in my own experience, I did need retreats to have that learning. And that is why, I believe, in short periods, I can really let go quickly. And my peak experience of deep rest is I don't think I've ever had such a deep rest state, is really this year. I got to go on 2 weeks of James's silent retreat, the month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. And I was monitoring, I had my Aura ring. I mean, all the channels were telling me, like, this is, you know, an unbelievably sacred place. It's just so privileged to be able to have such support and have, you know, a week on each end to be there. I say on each end because I think the settling in takes a while, and then, you know, having to go takes you out of it. But it's mm-hmm. that middle period.
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's people can do daily practice, and that's fabulous. If you never go on a retreat, you are training yourself to at least step off the hamster wheel and come to a place of connection, and even more deeply at times find that blue space. But if you can go on a retreat, it's like it's a whole other world where your body and your mind understand what deep rest is like, and then you're able to you know where home is. So once you know where home is, you want to keep on hanging out there. That's why people like going on retreats. Not that they failed and they have to get it again, but it's just they're recharging in that very profound way, which affects as they go out into the world, and it more and more gives you access to that place. So
beautiful. You know home. You know what it feels like. You can return to it. I have some questions for all of you, and I invite you to chat your answer if you're comfortable. The sharing answer shows us both the range of how different we are, as well as how universal we are. There's always overlap in our answers. So when we think about it, this is just, I'm really interested in your answers, and this is just a start, but let's start here. One question is, what stresses you out most, more on a regular basis in your regular life? What really gets you. So I don't mean traumas we all face. I mean, those are going to be the big ones, but really, what's the repeating routine that is in your week or month that you know is going to happen again?
And they should put that in the chat box right now.
I would love to see some answers.
Here we go. COVID, marriage, lack of focus, news. I'm just reading this, especially for people who later on are listening or watching, are listening on Dharma Seed. Fear, chronic pain, endless to-do list, loneliness, difficulties my children have, own self-critical mind, finances, self-doubt. Yeah, we know these. They seem familiar.
Yes.
Living arrangement. Yes. Work deadlines. Yeah.
And as a stress researcher, there's so much here. Some of your answers are the externals for the stressors that are really tough. And some are the responses, your own thoughts or feelings to situations. So there's something behind those emotions and their triggers to that self-critical mind. So now even getting more subtle, I am curious to hear about uncertainty stress. So uncertainty is, the stress of uncertainty is not knowing exactly what is going to happen, period. It could be happen today during an event. It could be happening that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, or, you know, during the pandemic, the uncertainty stress was, right, it was roaring in front of us that we didn't know what would happen today, or, you know, to work, to school, everything. So we have different levels of uncertainty tolerance, and that turns out to be an incredibly important both individual trait that we have, how comfortable we are with uncertainty, but as well as a muscle we can build. When we realize uncertainty is lurking and bothering us at a subtle level, and we can identify it, that then we can actually build our uncertainty muscle. So at the beginning of that meditation, James brought us to here and now and asked us to drop some of the baggage we were taking in. He asked us to start over. There were all sorts of cues to let us let go of any expectations and vigilance about the future, because we were all in our body and with you in the moment. So being present is, of course, one of the biggest antidotes to uncertainty stress.
And I just want to also mention in the book, the first day is about dealing with uncertainty, that things will go wrong. This is the first noble truth. There's suffering, and how to deal with that stress that comes from uncertainty, from not knowing. Is that right? So you're now asking.
Well, actually, okay. So we James, did you want to comment on anything feeling from this perspective, like the stress of the unknown?
Yeah, you know, and what you call a catch and release kind of practice is how to hold feelings of uncertainty, which is, that's life. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? Who knows what the next moment will bring? In fact, it's one of my favorite teachings of Joseph Goldstein. Anything can happen at any time. And so rather than being vigilant and thinking, oh, that's the way that I'm going to protect myself, the Buddha suggests actually a radical practice, which is contemplate that, yes, old age, sickness, death, and loss are part of the package. He says, reflect on this every day, not to freak you out, not to get you in a morbid state of hypervigilance, but more and more to inoculate you to the facts of life that we don't know the next moment, and living in the future is a sure way to miss out on your life. So it's an invitation to come into the present moment, that this is where the real refuge is. And the more you can come into the present moment without getting lost in the future, the more you're able to respond wisely to this moment. And the more you practice responding wisely to this moment, you become more and more trusting that your awareness will meet the next moment when it comes, whatever it happens to bring. And this is what's called sadha, or trust, that not trust that everything is going to work out, but trust that your awareness can meet that moment, because you've been practicing being here in this one instead of toppling forward with fear and worry.
It's beautiful. And just to show you how much this stance matters, the sadha, when we measure this, and I measured it in a big Bay Area cohort during COVID, it predicts anxiety and depression from COVID. It also predicts like the more severe type of climate distress. It is such a vulnerability factor for chronic anxiety. And so it's earlier and it's underlying. And so it's something we can get at and think about in our practice, and just leaning back, James, you know, that whole leaning forward to mm-hmm. meet the future, and leaning back is a nice bodily cue mm-hmm. that experience will come to you and mm. you can trust that mm. you'll be able to respond.
Yeah. And I just want to mention throughout the book, besides the research and the points, there are these exercises and practices that people are invited to do over the course of these 7 days or 7 years, if you want to do it, really go in deeply each one, or keep on going around and around. So this is all about practicing. It's more than just, oh, I get the answer. It's like when I first heard about the mindfulness practice. Oh, I got it. I just have to be mindful. Yeah, well, good luck. It takes practice again and again. I've been doing it for a long time, and I have to practice regularly to remember to come back. So this is all about practicing what's good for you. Mm-hmm. As my mother used to say, if you know what's good for you, this is what's good for you. It's really practicing what's good for you, really knowing what's good for you. And dealing with uncertainty is a key. I just want to mention that maybe we can, in order to have some more time for conversation, but just to let people know that the second one is all about control. And it's really you take a stress inventory, and you're really learning to let go of the control that you never had in the first place. Maybe you can just say a little bit about that.
You said it very well. I think we deserve to take time to really look carefully at our life and reflect on both the big situations that will come up more easily, as well as those small, subtle ones that are more built into our life, maybe triggered by people, or interactions by people, or our schedule, or rushing. We've found, one question for you all is like, how much do you rush? What percent of each day are you rushing? Work days, that is one of the probably stressors we share. There are different stages of life, but in our studies, that's one of the most common daily stressors, is that people have schedules that basically eliminate the ability to be very mindful, to have any green or blue mind states. It's just go, go, go. So that's, I would say, the lowest hanging fruit is delete, simplify. Mm-hmm. If you're serious about being present for your life, going through it in a rush just sets you up for that mm-hmm. that challenge. So looking at, so it guides you to make some lists, put things in buckets, and sort out what needs some of that letting go and acceptance versus more problem solving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I see,
that's
yeah.
kind of like the in my joy course, one of the themes is the joy of letting go. And we were talking about this before in Buddhism, the word that the Buddha talks about, here's my chat box, is nekama. Let me put it in the chat box, which is what the Buddha talks of as the joy of renunciation. However, it's a better word is simplifying and just getting some space. So, you know, most of us are caught in the busyness of life. And if you really want to have some, it's all about spaciousness. And if you want to have less stress, figuring out, discerning between what you absolutely need to do from what you want, or all the things you want to do or feel you should do, and having that kind of wise discernment. Yeah. So, and just let me quickly ask you. So the third one is be the lion. What is that?
That is a meaty topic we could go deep into, especially so the science shows that our beliefs and our self-talk.
Let me just mute everybody, and then you unmute yourself. If you are, no, you're on. Okay. Yeah.
I'm in. I just saw that my parents logged on. Hi, Mom. You must have gotten my message. and I have been at James's retreats with them too. So be like the lion, not the gazelle. So when we are in the middle, when we're approaching some tough situation, we know that it's going to be stressful. We can arm ourselves with what stance. How do we want to be in this situation? And so there are many pretty amazing lab studies that really dissect what are thoughts, what are the type of responses, the thoughts, the feelings that drive the stress response toward the threat response. That's the over-exaggerated cortisol response, slow recovery, vasoconstriction. And then there's the positive stress response, more like the lion than the gazelle. And we don't know what the lion's thinking besides, I'm about to get dinner, I hope. But for humans, this whole positive mindset, it's different set of emotions and thoughts of empowerment, of feelings of hope, enthusiasm, control, feeling more positive emotion, period. Mm-hmm. That we can actually maintain positive emotion during stressors, or even after them, we can regain some sense of content, relief, ease, and that ability to hold on to positive emotion or feel it is related to less of an inflammatory response in one of our lab studies. So there's many studies that show that we can change our thoughts, we can reappraise things, and that leads to a more adaptive stress response. We have a peak of anxiety and stress, it goes right down, same with the physiology. So that's a chapter people tend to really like, because, and especially men, because it feeds into this, I've noticed, this idea of, you know, I think it's a very, to me, it's not a competitive type of stress, but it's very much a, like, I got this, go, you know, go get them, sports type, athletic mindset. Mm-hmm. A competitive athlete mindset. Anyway, so that is, it's interesting because I think people need to come up with to look at example statements and come up with their own. And what I was just describing to you are really about the activating thoughts of both what we can say to ourselves to feel like we're going to survive and do well, that we have what it takes. You can remind yourself of what resources you have, what social support you have. There's a lot of ways to reevaluate this situation and look at it from a more strength or gain perspective. Mm-hmm. But there are all sorts of other thoughts we need, mindsets we need during stress. One is perspective taking, this too will pass. I can get through this. My body will recover from this. There are beautiful studies from my colleagues, Oz Aduk at Berkeley and Ethan Cross, that show just reminding ourselves or asking ourselves, will this affect me in a year, mm-hmm. is incredibly shifting toward this more quick recovery and resilient stress response. So it's impermanence. Mm-hmm. It's reminding ourselves that things are always changing, and that it shifts us from that catastrophic place to,
mm-hmm.
I can get through this.
And this is really the essence of what I get, what the Buddha taught, that you can train yourself to not get lost in the fearful thoughts and choose which thoughts really serve you if you've taken enough of an exploration of your mind. And the first line in the Dhammapada has always been so profound to me. We are what we think. With our thoughts, we make the world. And this, you're saying, you can actually train yourself to choose thoughts that support you in stress rather than getting stuck in the feedback loop. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Thank you. No, I love that. And I've taken Mark Coleman's meditation teacher training. Mm. And so one of his big focuses is the self-critic. And the line that I'll never forget is, everything about our body supports us. Everything about our body is towards survival and is helping us, except one thing, our self-critical thoughts. Mm-hmm. Mara.
Yeah. So we don't have that much time left, and you have to read the book to get the others. I want to open it up to the to conversation and just mention that there's talk about resilience and about and one theme is about the power of nature to nourish us and relieve stress. And there's a day on relaxation and restoration, and then there's the science of happiness, all filled with research and very user-friendly ways to cultivate that. But I thought maybe in the time we have left, we could open it up to some conversation, unless there's something you want to say before we do that, that we can then take some Q&A.
Let's open it up. I thank you for reviewing the book and the idea of hermetic stress or using the bodily stress response is also in there. And that's more of how the body heals from stress is very anti-aging. So there's a lot of, surprise in that one chapter. But yeah, let's definitely take some questions.
So if you want to ask something or have an observation that you think would be useful for all of us to hear about Alyssa's response, you can go down to the reactions box in the bottom of your screen and hit the raise hand, so it'll be easier to see, because there's a couple of pages worth of people. So anything.
And can everyone see each other? Should we put it on gallery view?
You can put it on. You can all put it on gallery view. I can remove that, but everyone can just put on gallery view. I'm going to add on somebody who asks and put them in the spotlight. I can add them to the spotlight too. So you can go up to the right-hand corner and go to gallery view, and then you'll see everyone, or just go to speaker view. So anybody who has something they want to ask about or raise. Yeah, Debbie, hi, hold on, I'm going to put you on with us. There you go, magic.
All right, thank you. So my question is about dealing with chronic health conditions. And, you know, when you said, like, the question, is this going to be an issue a year from now? You know, and I thought about sort of the stuff I'm dealing with and was like, yeah, Probably so. You know, and so it was not a comforting question for that particular issue. So I'm just wondering, like, what strategies you might suggest for something like that.
Right. And that's a great example. And I put that in a different category. So how is this going to affect us in 6 months or a year is dinner table conversation. That's about our day. But when we have these really challenging life conditions that may not end, it's a different animal, and it takes a different set of coping strategies. And it is probably one of our best examples of chronic stress. The things we study are, you know, relationship conflict, work burnout, caregiving, and health problems. I mean, those are just, they're common, and they just go on and on. And so we easily burn out if we're not having good strategies. So one of the strategies is really understanding how to manage your personal battery and your needs. And this really goes to anyone also who's stress sensitive. We have different levels of sensitivity to stress and have different amounts of self-care need. And so figuring out, you know, what is the structure of my day? How many hours go into self-care? And can I have my support network understand that and support me so that you don't have people stepping on your boundaries, et cetera, but rather being supportive? James, did you want to?
Sure. Like I said before, the Buddha said to reflect on this every day. It's one of the five recollections. Well, two: old age and illness. He said this is part of the package of being alive. So first, to somehow come to terms with reality, rather than wishing it were different. That's a tall order, but that's what reality is asking of us, because in our wishing it were different, or hoping, of course you want to do everything you can to maximize your health, but things are the way they are. And we can either wish they weren't that way and add on more contraction and fear and bitterness or helplessness or whatever, or say, okay, this is how it is. Now, how can I relate to this circumstance without adding on more confusion? But rather, for instance, relating to your body instead of with anger and annoyance and frustration, relating to it with deep appreciation for all the ways that it supports you. I do a lot of metta practice, or encourage people to do a lot of metta practice, not just for themselves, but to their body, to the places that are doing their best to try to serve you, but have, you know, the way of impermanence have broken down in a way, just like everything breaks down, and appreciate the rest of your body, and appreciate those muscles or those nerves or whatever it is, and having a different relationship with that. And as Alyssa is saying, let that be a motivation for self-care and appreciation for all the things that are going well, because so much is about our attitude towards the circumstance.
And I'll just add the hermetic stress piece. You obviously know meditation, you're here, and the experimenting with small doses of stress and seeing if it helps with symptoms and energy is a whole nother realm that people with chronic conditions can explore. So in my book, I talk about Wim Hof breathing, for example, in hot and cold.
What Wim Hof is say a little bit about him and what he advocates.
So he's kind of popularizing a protocol for for some of the extreme breath work, that it's similar to maybe Tummo breathing, the Tibetan type of breathing. There's some hyperventilation and then there's some breath holding. And so people can try it very gently at first and then more intensely and see how it affects them. It's been, I have a sister who had helped her some, let's say, pro-inflammatory or autoimmune type conditions. So there's not just anecdotal, there's just small studies suggesting that it can help with inflammation and lots of anecdotes.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you. Anything else? Anyone wants some? Oh, yeah. Kimberly. Hi. Let me put you up on the spotlight. Yeah. Oh, and I'll remove you. Thank you, Debbie. Here we are.
Aloha, and thank you both, and Sangha, thank you all. James, to carry on from what you were saying, mm-hmm. how do we do this, or if we accomplish this, to have a good attitude for ourselves, and we're trying, no matter what stressors are, you know, piling up, if we are on a particular path and our partner is not on that same path, so that every day we're having 24/7 this different way to be that's not on, I don't just mean to mirror at all, but to be on a similar path. If that person's not on our Buddhist mindful path, how do we keep trying to be like, okay, you know, Susie Sunshine, it's all okay. I get it. I mean, I'm not trying to be that facetious, but honestly, because it's sort of like that similar thing of saying on the cushion, it's easy, right? And then when reality, there's a whole nother thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out how to be in a household every day, all day, with someone who's not on the same path.
Let me ask you before I or Alyssa have any response. In your wisest moments, how do you work with the situation?
To be completely honest, I don't feel that I have wisest moments because I truly try. I take a day of the week. I used to have a silent Monday, and then I changed it to be kind to my partner day, where I literally forced myself to only react in a positive manner. And it was so draining and so hard because this person can be quite negative. So it's challenging. And I try to be supportive, and I'm like, okay. And then whoom, down, you know, so it's hard because it's not their way to be. And that's what I'm trying to figure it out. I'm trying to figure it out, James, you know, I don't know. No. I truly don't feel that I know.
Okay, I hear you. Alyssa, do you have any
thoughts? I know you were asked this exact question a lot, and I'm dying to hear your answer.
Well, I wish I could give you a magic button to change him, or, you know, it's hard enough to change your own self, let alone somebody else's. So this is what you've got. And a few things do occur to me. One, I hope you're getting a whole lot of support and connection with like-minded friends that do nourish you, that do, you're not going to get it likely from your partner. So make sure, we need Sangha. We need people to reflect back to us. So I'm glad you're here tonight and hope you come back or find other Sanghas. That's one thing. Two, this is what you've got. You've got a couple of choices. Either wish it weren't that way and be miserable, get out, or if it's not serving you, or somehow come to terms and have very healthy boundaries. Doesn't have to mean that you never talk, but your practice is not to take on his negativity.
Right, exactly.
And to just have compassion with some boundaries and not try to convince him to be on your path. That's not gonna work. No, thank you for the feedback. You're on your own path. But he can be your teacher in compassion and patience.
Yes, absolutely.
And boundaries.
Yeah. And you're not the first person to say that most likely this is my big teacher. And I'm trying to embrace that. And I don't want to create that he's not a completely negative person. It's just that I haven't figured out how to do the things that you both are talking about. And and I see the reactions. There are other people who are saying, yes, well, how do we do that? So I know I'm not alone. But...
No, you're not. And one thing I would say that does occur to me for, you know, if it's the same principle as if you've got a teenager, okay, who's, are they going to make it through or I'm going to lose myself? Keep looking for things that are good about him.
Absolutely.
And even name it. And the more you, it's like, you know, a big principle, the more you look for the good, the more you will find it because your brain has that kind of start, shift the confirmation bias. And the more you are, you're practicing looking for the good instead of, oh, there he goes again. So that becomes your practice and name it, because the more you name it, the more it just gives energy to that. And sure. I appreciate your practice. Make it a practice challenge and get a lot of really good support.
Yeah. Thank you, James. And Alyssa, thank you. I'm sorry I didn't mean to left turn away from the discussion of your book, because it sounds amazing.
Your question is relevant to everything so I appreciate you asking it. And it's a hard question to ask. And I just want to say that what we talked about earlier, when James was saying, you know, really, you know, in the case of a chronic condition, trying to move away from that, you know, wishing things were different. Of course, we wish things were different. Right. So it's very, you know, we can't change. I only have one friend who's actually here, whose partner actually turned into, you know, a Dharma practitioner and joined her. And I was like, wow, when's that going to happen to my husband? And, you know, and then I realized that just, you know, there's so much beauty and good and love that just, you know, to stop longing for being, you know, having the same interest or path in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And we need to wrap it up. And I just want to first, on that last piece that, the key principle is it's not what's happening out there, but it's what is my relationship to what's happening? How can I have a healthy relationship to my reality? Alyssa, what a delight to share with you. Any final thought as we say goodbye?
I'm grateful to have had this time with you all. It was a really fun conversation with great questions. It was just as I'd hoped. We didn't know what was going to unfold, and it was juicy.
So great. The stress prescription, I'll just plug it once again. 7 days to more joy and ease. Check it out. It's really good.
Michelle just told me there's only one review. So if you do like it, and you do like online things, it would be lovely to have more than one review on Amazon. She's talking
on Amazon. Okay, that's good to know. Let's just have a moment of dedicating the merit and our good fortune. Here we are together on a Thursday evening with like-minded friendship. We have some very good karma in our life to be interested and able to come together. And let's wrap up all of the good that comes from our being here together and put it all in one great big ball of merit, as Joanna Macy says, and send it out into the world. May our coming here together be of benefit to ourselves, everyone in our lives, and ripple out to be a benefit to all beings everywhere in this beautiful planet that we share.
Thank you.
So here's
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.